Welcome to the Risk and Repeat podcast, episode number 31. I'm Rob Wright, editor of Search Security, and I am here with my site editor, Peter Loschen. Peter, welcome.
Hi, Rob.
Good to be back. I know it was just a few days ago that we recorded our last episode. It's been a lot of episodes, a lot of turnaround or short turnaround between security events, I guess, in recent history for us. So we're back at it again in Chernobyl, the radioactive podcast studio, this time to talk about, one step forward, two steps back, I guess personified for the InfoSec industry. We're talking about Avalanche, the major cybercrime ring that was offering a crimeware as a service, a hosting service, for all manner of cyber criminals in many different countries. Talking about that and how law enforcement teamed up, and took this criminal enterprise down, and an unexpected development that happened just a couple days later after this was taken down that really is almost unbelievable. It actually is kind of unbelievable, but we'll get to that in a minute. Peter, you wrote the story on the Avalanche takedown.
I did.
Summarize.
So 4 years of investigation. The investigation did not start with one of the big, you know, famous national agencies.
Not Interpol, not the FBI.
Not NSA.
Not NSA.
Well, of course, not those guys, but not FBI.
They're looking at other more important things.
Right. Well, it started out with a couple of local jurisdictions in Germany. It was started in 2012 by the public prosecutor's office in the German town of Verden. V-E-R-D-E-N.
So Verden?
And in German, you pronounce the V like an F in English.
Verden.
And the Lüneburg police in Germany.
Okay.
And was carried out ultimately in cooperation with the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Western District of Pennsylvania, Department of Justice and the FBI, Europol, Eurojust, also was involved there, the EU Agency for Judicial Cooperation on Cross-Border Criminal Investigations, and all told, prosecutors and investigators from 30 countries, 4 years. This was big.
Hit me with some more numbers.
Okay, they searched 37 premises. They seized 39 servers.
Love it.
Victims of the malware infections were identified in over 180 countries, which is pretty much probably mostly all of them.
Fair point.
Also, 221 servers were put offline through abuse notifications sent to the hosting providers. The operation marks the largest ever use of sinkholing to combat botnet infrastructures, and unprecedented in its scale, with over 800,000 domains seized, sinkholed, or blocked. And that was from
Europol.
Was that from Europol?
I believe it was. Or maybe I'm wrong.
It was, I think it might have been the U.S. Those numbers were pretty much offered by everybody
who was
involved.
Oh, yeah, Europol and Europol.
U.S. CERT.
U.S. CERT.
FBI probably had.
Yeah, FBI. Wow.
So anyway, they targeted over 40 major financial institutions.
And the number of arrests?
The number of arrests, that's a really good question.
I think it was five, the document I'm looking at.
Okay.
It seems, given the scale and scope of this operation, the law enforcement operation, and we haven't even got into the scale and scope of the crime where as a service operation, that seems like a small number.
Well, that's the power of computers.
I guess so.
Right?
The power
it's
of cyber.
All automated of cyber, yeah.
And I know you've said it before, but we're in the wrong business.
Yeah, but at least we don't have to. Well, we'll
look
get
over
in,
our shoulder.
Well,
or go to jail.
Gunfights.
We'll get into that in a second.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But
so, yeah, continue.
So, all right, Avalanche uses as many as 500,000 infected computers daily. The Officials said that they have infected over the years millions of computers with malware, which could be used for harvesting banking and email credentials. Mm-hmm. That was from U.S. CERT. Here the numbers were roughly, it's like some people were saying 19, some people were saying 20-ish, two dozen, but a lot of different malware families were being distributed over this.
Not that this needs to be a sticking point, but there were some conflicting numbers on that. But what I have in front of me, the U.S. CERT information on it.
Yep.
So this is important to note. This is malware families. So there's a malware family, and there are many different variants in a lot of cases of that family. And according to U.S. CERT, I mean, these are some heavy hitters. These are things that we've written a lot about: Tesla Crypt, VawTrack, the banking Trojan, banking malware, VM Zeus. I mean, these are Citadel. Like, these are this is bad news. These are things that have wreaked havoc on a lot of different enterprises, a lot of different organizations, a lot of different people, and they're heavy hitters. I mean, this is like a murderer's row of malware families that were being hosted on this site. And also, Peter.
Yes.
Apparently, the volume of phishing attacks was pretty tremendous that was hosted on this platform, on the Avalanche platform. It was hosting as much as 2/3 of all phishing attacks on banking and e-commerce, phishing attacks designed to harvest banking and e-commerce credentials. And, you know, at its peak, probably 20+ different malware families hosted on the platform. I mean,
also botnets.
The botnets.
At least command and control services for at least 8 different botnets.
So this is tremendous.
Yeah.
And the botnet thing, I feel like, not to spend too much time on refining the points about this operation, but I feel like the botnets, that part of it's been kind of secondary to the malware and the phishing, and maybe it should be. But the botnet, I mean, the fact that they had this platform, they had this infrastructure, they were basically a cloud service, a cyber crimeware as a service platform. And the fact that they had this infrastructure and they could run command and control pretty easily, well, it's no wonder that there was so much botnet activity tied to this, because that is like, you do need some type of command and control resource. And there have been a lot of attacks recently that, I mean, there was one a while back, I think they were using, there was a phishing campaign that was using Dropbox. They set up legit Dropbox accounts, and they were using that as sort of their staging server to run these phishing attacks on people. So, you know, I mean, that's an important part of the botnet picture. And it's no wonder, like I said, that much activity had been tied to it. So,
One of the reasons that it took so long to take this down.
Yes.
Double Flux, right?
Yeah. Wrote about this in the story, and I don't understand it. The double fast flux.
Right.
Like,
sorry.
They were doing tricky things with DNS to avoid. I still, okay. Let me just state for the record before you get into this. It's a little alarming that, number one, The investigation into this Avalanche group, this crimeware infrastructure, was initiated at the local level, and that for all the surveillance and intelligence that we gather with our national government law enforcement agencies, not just here, but in the UK and other major countries, we didn't know anything about this apparently before 2012, and that after finding out about it in 2012, it took another 4 years almost to find these guys. Like, are these guys, I mean, do we need to hire them after they get out of jail? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. But yeah, like,
so
tell me about this
double fast flux. Yeah, it's like double secret overtime or whatever, but double fast flux with DNS. So you can change, there's two dimensions that they use to change rapidly and programmatically. information about the DNS, because if you're listening in to the traffic, you can see the traffic going in and out from these. And they're oddly named servers. They're not. It's not Google.com.
Right.
It's like HPX !_47_3.io or something. Mm-hmm. So we've got these different domain names. And the reason there were so many of them, 800,000 were over 800,000 were taken down. What the bad guys were doing, they didn't register them ahead of time. They registered them in live.
Yeah.
Ongoing.
The flash part.
Right. And if you exactly. If you know how a secure ID or one of those hardware tokens that generates every 60 seconds or 30 seconds a new PIN that you use, and that's your two-factor authentication method. So the same type of algorithm, you can make it seem sort of random, but it's not random. So you can pre-compute all these things so that you know that if you're going to use one of these tokens at 10:47 and 32 seconds, this will be the PIN that you can use. And you can calculate that ahead for a year.
Wow.
It's just an algorithm. It's just a pseudo-random algorithm. So what they did was they implemented this on both sides, on the malware side. The infected, the infection will go through and it'll come up with these domains that it thinks are going to be active at that particular time.
Right.
And the command and control system is registering just before it needs to use it, and possibly deregistering, or maybe not. I'm going to say not.
But pretty quickly.
But yeah, I mean, they're registering it right before it needs to be used. So the first fast flux is they're changing the domains. They're changing where the domain names are pointing to. So it goes from.
I thought it was just the domains. Oh no, that's, I take that back. It changes the IP address too. The story says.
Okay, so that's one of the one of the things you can do to avoid detection and avoid getting disrupted if you're an attacker, a malicious actor, is you can keep fluxing the domain names that you're going to.
So,
but the second fast flux, what they do is when they have a domain that's in use, they can change the DNS, the canonical DNS server that you're going to get the translation of that domain. So if you're looking at it right now and you're a defender and you look up the DNS server,
mm-hmm.
by the time you get there, it will have changed to a different server. So you'll get to the server and it'll say, "Hey, I don't know anything about this guy." It'll be some other domain server, and if you can figure out how to figure out. I mean, you have to figure out how to figure out what the next step is.
Right. And if you don't know, then you're not going to know what the next domain is.
Right.
So not only were they doing, so like a typical cyber criminal might hide their IP address, they might mask their IP address, but what these guys were doing was essentially a step further by using these domains in sort of rapid succession and only using them when the minute that they needed them, and then getting rid of them, and so cycling through them rapidly.
Or shifting them to another DNS.
Or shifting them, to another,
root DNS server.
Okay.
But yeah, so the thing is that I'm not convinced that the criminals were not using this type of technique, but I think partially because a lot of them were using this service, this crimeware as a service. This Avalanche, if you're on Avalanche, then you've got this great defenses. So that's all, that's sort of the technical side of it.
It's just weird that, I mean, so this isn't like an unknown, I mean, it was unknown to me. Like I had never heard of this technique before, but I assume probably most experts know about this. And it just seems odd that an operation this big would be able to do it to the point that they could hide for several years. I mean, like Brian Krebs, a great InfoSec reporter, he's covered this, and he talked about how, you know, they've been suspected of, you know, attacks and cybercrime activity years before 2012, before they were first found.
Right, 2009? 2008,
2009.
I think that was the first that they were detected, not the first.
Yeah, right. I mean,
we don't know when they started.
We don't know when they actually started. Yeah. It's just to be able to use this technique that probably, like I said, most experts were familiar with, but not find a way around. Like, it's one thing to try to crack Tor. Like, if you know people are using Tor, well, you look for a vulnerability in it. But if you're using this technique, well, I mean, there's got to be some way that, you know.
Yeah, well, that's why it took a lot of people to crack this case.
Yeah.
And so do you want to talk about the end game here? Because I don't want to let the listeners go too long without
getting it. Yeah, no, we should get to the development.
This is why you and I are not going to get into this business.
Right, because, all right, so... So, yeah, so the law enforcement, the joint effort between Europe, UK, US, they run this crackdown on Avalanche. They make 5 arrests. And apparently the alleged leader of this gang, a 33-year-old Russian citizen named Gennady Kapkanov. I don't know if I'm pronouncing the first name right. I think Kapkanov, I'm probably pronouncing correctly. So I guess what happened was on November 30th, when these raids started happening, Ukraine authorities, police showed up at Kapkanov's residence, and he allegedly shot at the arresting officers with a Kalashnikov. An AK-47 assault rifle, which is kind of serious business. If you've ever seen an action movie, Peter, you know what an AK-47 is.
I've seen an action.
Yeah, there you go. So he attempted to escape off his you know, apartment balcony. I mean, it was
fourth,
you know,
floor, right?
Oh, fourth floor. But they arrested him. They booked him on these cybercrime charges. Now, this is where I'm not entirely sure what's going on here. I'm just going off of reports. And the reports that we're getting are basically translated from Russian and Ukrainian sourced material. And who knows what's going on there? I mean, not just because of the language barrier, but I mean, it's media reports in another country that, well, you know what's going on in Russia with state-run media. So apparently... The judge in the Ukraine that was presiding over Kapkanov's case, the charges, ordered him released, saying that the prosecution didn't, the police and the prosecution did not file the proper charges, that they should have booked him on charges of shooting at police officers and, you know, evading arrest, obstruction of justice, whatever the equivalent charges were, and not the cybercrime charges, as if the cybercrime charges didn't happen, as if because you shot at a police officer, then that means you didn't commit the cybercrime. I don't understand. I mean, like, I would need a full season of Law and Order, you know, Ukraine, to be able to explain to me what they're even talking about with this, because it makes no sense to me. Regardless, no.
So, the report I read indicated that when they brought him in, they booked him on cybercrime.
Yes.
And they figured that would be good. And I like to make things up.
Sure.
Conjecture.
Make things up.
Yeah.
Conjecture.
So my conjecture is that they probably had all the paperwork nice, and, you know, the big stack of paperwork to take him in for cybercrime was all good. They went in, they booked him on cybercrime because that's what they had. They wanted to get him into a cell because he just shot at them. And they figured, well, okay, he's in a cell. Once he gets in the cell, we can sort out the other crimes. And my conjecture is that the judge, the lawyer, his lawyer, or somebody came up and said to the judge, hey, can you release him on his own recognizance?
You just
or on bail or whatever.
Yeah, you just ask?
Well, that, yeah. If you don't ask, they're not going to do it.
If you don't ask for a new computer, you're not going to get one.
That's right. Well, so, this is my conjecture and from filling in the blanks from the report I read was that they, because the thing that they charged him with, cyber, was not violent, and they figured, okay, fine, we'll let him go, you know, whatever, however that works over there. Maybe I'm thinking that maybe that's what happened. And then he took off, and he's gone. So they're still looking at him. And by the way, Gennady, if we didn't pronounce your name right and you're listening, give us a call.
No, put the Kalashnikov down. Put the Kalashnikov down. Do not come at us. I'm reading the story, and, you know, so they release him. Apparently the Ukraine police, knowing that this guy took shots at cops. I don't know how things are done in Ukraine, but I would believe that, like, if he did get out on a technicality here, that he would be under heavy surveillance to make sure that he did not go, you know, 10 feet without, some type of surveillance unit or detail on this guy. Yeah, maybe I watched too much of The Wire, the greatest history show or television show in the history of television. But this is absurd to me. So he is released. He somehow, this master criminal who, maybe he's really good with cloud and cybercrime and all that, but, like, what did he do? Was this Mission Impossible? He just up and vanished? He's able to evade authorities. Now I'm reading that the Ukraine's prosecutor general, essentially their attorney general, is calling for the firing of the prosecutor in the case. Because, I guess he botched the charges? I mean, that seems pretty harsh. So this guy is back in the wild. I know the operation's been taken down, and this is an interesting point that we maybe skipped over a little. It's a minor point, but apparently the authorities in the case were working with another organization, the Shadow Server Foundation, a nonprofit organization, and they helped law enforcement sort of reclaim or take control of some of these avalanche domains, a lot of them, if not all of them, to try to sort things out. That's your good news, okay? The good news is that they've taken control of that, that the infrastructure is being dismantled. They know what malware families were being hosted. They know what phishing attacks that the operation from a technical standpoint is taken down. But this guy, the alleged ringleader, is back out there in the wild. He's got a Kalashnikov.
Well, no, I saw pictures.
Or he had a Kalashnikov.
He had a Kalashnikov and an automatic pistol.
Oh, that's fantastic.
They showed a picture in one of the stories.
And this guy's running around wild.
But there's a lot of snow on the ground apparently out there. Because there was a lot of snow in the picture with the guns.
I mean, and I just want to point out in your story, which was excellent, by the way, very lengthy, very detailed story. You know, there's a section in it, the new model for global cybercrime fighting, and we've written about this in the past, but just about the cooperation between law enforcement agencies on an international basis to find these guys that hide behind stuff like the flash flood.
Double fast flux.
Double flash flux. Say that three times. And finding these guys that hide behind that, and like bulletproof hosting and anonymizing techniques. That's great. So you do all this work, you get this guy, and then you let him slip through your fingers. I mean, what must the DHS, US CERT, FBI be thinking about this now? Like, all that work put in, this guy's back out there. Who knows if he has stuff backed up somewhere, if he has contingency plans. I usually tend to think of these guys as not the, you know, Lex Luthor criminal masterminds that we sometimes start to think that they are from media portrayals. I mean, you look at the guy, Best Buy, no offense, Best Buy, but Best Buy with these botnet attacks, the IoT devices, like, I mean, like, he, like, allegedly, he talked with Motherboard, great Motherboard story about some of the recent stuff going on with these IoT attacks, and he came out and he said, oh, I've got these, I found a vulnerability to these routers and I've pwned them, and here's the data. And they ask him, the reporters for the Motherboard article, okay, what are you going to do? And he's like, probably, P-R-O-L-Y, get drunk. I mean, these guys are not.
If he can find somebody old enough to buy
him
some beer.
Yeah, if he can find someone old enough to buy him the alcohol. Yeah, I mean, they're not criminal masterminds, I feel like. But that doesn't mean that this guy, that he can't, you know, now that he's slipped through the fingers of law enforcement, can't get an operation back up and running. We know how easy it is to get stuff running when you're from a cloud perspective. This is just troubling. This is, I mean, if this isn't the, you know, putting prune juice in the punch bowl in this holiday season, I don't know what is. I mean, this is just.
So let me blow your mind a little
bit.
Okay,
blow my mind more.
This is something, the idea behind this came to me, got to be at least a year ago. Who's in everybody's computers? Is it the good guys or the bad guys?
Probably the bad guys.
The bad guys.
Yeah.
They can take your computer over, use it to make their little botnets and command and control and all that other stuff.
Their click fraud.
Right, exactly. And the smart ones are doing it so that it doesn't impair your ability to use the computer. Yeah. So now, let me ask you.
Yes.
How much do you spend on antivirus or scanning software? You know, the...
I decline to answer this question.
All right. Well, how much does an average antivirus or personal...
A subscription for a consumer-grade product you can probably get for, you know, between, I don't know, $60, $70, I don't know, for your subscription
per year.
Couple devices. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So...
Not a lot. Under $100.
Now, how much would you pay to somebody who could promise you that not only would your computer be free of malware, but if anybody tried to hack you would get hacked way back? What I'm saying is that in the
That's
Wild West
question.
You know,
yeah.
The internet's the Wild West still. In the Wild West, when you're out in Dry Gulch wherever and there's 14 people in the town and somebody gets killed, you don't call the sheriff because there is no sheriff.
Yeah,
you get a posse together.
Yeah.
Well, these guys, I think, are, the other point is that when you get the posse together, you want the guys that don't mind shooting another guy.
Yeah.
So some of your posse members are going to be bad guys too.
Yeah.
Maybe not in your town, but in another town.
Sure.
So what happens when the Wild West gets more settled down? The people who have been keeping the law are going to continue to keep the law. So instead of being unknown wanted Cyberman number 13, they're going to be Sheriff Gennady. I'm sorry, I forgot his last name already.
Kapkanov.
It's not going to be Fugitive Kapkanov. It's going to be Sheriff Kapkanov.
I don't need someone showing up at Tech Target headquarters with a Kalashnikov.
Who says we're at Tech Target headquarters?
We're not. We're in Chernobyl. We're in Russia. Oh, man, I just realized that.
It's not actually in Russia. Belarus?
Is it?
Isn't it? But my point is that...
This is riveting audio for the audience.
Obviously, but to go to the more important point, if some cyber criminal were to come up and say, and send you, instead of a demand for one Bitcoin to decrypt your pictures of your kids... sent you a note saying, look, I have control of your system. If you give me $50 every year, I'll keep it clean for you.
Yeah.
And if you don't give me $50, I'll come in and I'll encrypt everything.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the fact is that the police so far are not attracting the talent to beat it.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if something like that happened, especially given the way history is being made this year, anyway.
You're saying they're going to give Kapkanov a job. He's going to be running U.S. Cyber Command.
I think that that some Bond villain guy is going to eventually figure out that getting subscriptions from every single computer user in the world for $50 a year forever is better than trying to fight against all these, you know, the ransomware and their defenses.
Yeah.
So, Chernobyl is in Ukraine.
Oh, in...
In Kiev Oblast.
Oh, okay.
And...
But Northern Ukraine near Belarus.
Right, yes, you've got it.
All right.
Okay.
Well, yes. There you have it.
So there it is. Chernobyl is in Ukraine.
Well, Peter, I feel like we've covered a lot of ground today. I haven't lost my mind too much, but you explained in expert detail the flash flood. I said flash flood again.
Double fast flux.
And the DNS trickery that these guys were using. And now everyone knows about it, so they can copy these guys. But yeah, not the last we're going to hear about Avalanche and Kapkinov, if we're pronouncing that right. And I'm sure we'll be seeing more of this, probably.
Yeah, why not? Yeah. Risk and repeat.
Yeah, there you go. Well, Peter, thank you for joining me today, as usual. It was a pleasure.
Always great to be here.
And thank you to everyone listening and reading Search Security and the Risk and Repeat podcast, as usual. I'm Rob Wright. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.